last week in alignment with the summer solstice, a England-based publisher released a book called Megaliths, A Study in Stone. So important was this book that the Telegraph and other international newspapers described the details of this new book and Earth's Neolithic past, the discovery of advanced geometry in many, if not most, of these massive stone structures, and why they were created, what the use was, and how they follow astronomical alignment of our planet and the heavenly bodies that surround us. Today, we'll speak with two of the authors and the publisher who believes that it's now time to release this information to the public. What is a megalith? Why were they built? And how were the massive stones, some weighing over 150 tons, moved into place? Later, we'll hear from our media critic, Adam Young, on ancient buildings in India. How were these buildings created, and what technology allowed them to carve with such detail is still a mystery to present-day science. All this in the news today on Earth Ancients. For June 30th, 2018, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, how you doing? This is Cliff. Welcome to Earth Ancients. Hope you're doing well. It is the holiday weekend. We got the holidays of independence. Those of us living in the United States celebrate what they call 4th of July holiday, which commemorates the signing of the Declaration of Independence from England. That means there's barbecue, beer, friends and family gathering. It's really it's a good time for barbecues. It's a good time to catch up with friends and things like that. And the weather's typically good here. I'm looking forward to getting together with some friends. So I hope you can do the same, or you're involved in some way, some form of a relaxation, because it's also a great time to get away and just do nothing. 4th of July this year is on Wednesday, and I am doing a family gathering on the 4th, which is a holiday. So looking forward to that. Hope you can do the same and enjoy yourself a little bit. This week is all about megaliths. It's all about megalithic stone structures, stone circles, massive dolmens and buildings, with a focus towards the UK. Now, I have seen some impressive dolmens in eastern United States. In fact, we've had a couple of people on the program that have been up north, North Salem, New York, and there's one dolmen there that has a 50-ton capstone on it, and we have photographs of it on the Facebook page. But there are a number of large dolmens north of New York and Massachusetts, and they're finding them all up and down the eastern United States, and they are very reminiscent of European-style dolmens, which is curious. Now, we don't know who made or who actually erected these dolmens, these megaliths. You have to kind of go back to some of the early people who chronicled dolmens, people like Dr. Barry Fell, who was a Harvard professor. He wrote a book called American BC. It came out originally in 1975, and then it was reprinted again in 1989. I strongly urge you, if you're interested in megaliths, to check out this book. It's excellent, and it's got great references, and it's he gets into the writing and the details behind the book, And it's called American BC, Druids in Vermont, Phoenicians in Iowa, Before the Time of Julius Caesar. I got a copy for $5 in a used bookstore about a year ago because I gave my original copy to a friend and never got it back. And this is an outstanding book. Not only does he show evidence of Romans in and Celtics, Celts in the Americas, he shows evidence of copper smelting. He shows evidence of language carved into stone, stone markers, and these dolmens that are a massive capstone weighing, you know, 20, 40, sometimes as much as 100 tons or more. And then below are smaller supporting stones, which are on the ground. And how in the hell they place these massive multi-ton stones in the positions that they are found today with little basic stones is beyond me. It's a real question, because they're many times you find them on hillsides where there's no trees, which means somehow they drag them from, you know, perhaps hundreds of feet or more to these locations and position them. There's still a great deal of curiosity about what their function is, but people like John Burke, who I've talked about a lot here, believe that a lot of them were built over telluric field. And they also have strange types of energetics. I've seen pictures of people's compasses going crazy, which means there's a magnetic effect. There's a lot of strange physics behind these dolmens. And today we're going to hear from two people who have studied them for a significant period of time and have found that there's a lot of anomalous features to not only dolmens, but to megaliths in general. Later in the show, we're going to have John Martinow, who is the publisher of Wooden Books, who published this new book on megaliths, talk a little bit about his belief. John happens also to be, or he's one of the original founders of megalithomania with Hugh Newman. So he's very much involved in the discovery, the study, the research behind megaliths, and is a researcher in his own right. But we'll hear from him and the importance of this new book. And then our main interview is with Robin Heath and Hugh Newman, who both co-authored this new book on megaliths. Should be a fun day. It's going to be an interesting discussion because they have these megaliths. I mean, Hugh is just a few, maybe a mile or less from Stonehenge. He lives right on that area where Stonehenge is located. So he studied and visits Stonehenge on a quite regular basis and brings tours there and things like that. So it's going to be a fun show all about megaliths today, megalithic structures. Earth Ancients is supported by your subscriptions. And to subscribe to Earth Ancients, you can go to Patreon, patreon.com/Earth Ancients. This summer, we're doing a drive to grow our subscribers to a total of 250 people. Each week we get some new subscribers. And hey, for as little as just $5, there's a ton of unpublished interviews. I'm even posting some books there. And I have some digital copies of this new book, Megaliths. If you want to get a copy, you can go to patreon.com/Earth Ancients. And just for $5, you get not only all the books, and each month I'm going to be posting a new book. I think I have enough that I can keep it going for at least 6 or 7 months. But I'm also going to be doing some new teleseminars, and subscribers can talk with people like Michael Cremo, Graham Hancock, Robert Bivol, Robert Schock. A ton of people will be interviews. Those interviews will start at the end of the summer, probably in September. But this is a chance to talk one-on-one with these authors, with these investigators, and kind of ask them questions that have been on your mind after listening to them here in the show or reading their books. So this week, I want to thank the following people for their donations. And remember, for $5 a month, that's all you need to be a subscriber. Thanks to Zach Muskanovich, Paul Mazzi, Jim Weber, Thomas Kraminski, Zach Maskovich, and Sandy Edwards. Thank you all for subscribing. Your subscriptions help keep the lights on and keep things moving right along here on Earth Ancients. So this week, it's All Things Megaliths. We're featuring a new book, Megaliths, A Study in Stone. Two of the authors, Hugh Newman and Robin Heath, and that is our feature today. But I wanted to bring in the publisher of this book because it's unusual for many, many reasons. One is that it's filled with wonderful engravings over the years. People have made different engravings of these sites. And also to get some background from the publisher, why he chose to publish this book. It's a very timely book, and some other details. The publisher is John Martineau, and he is with me right now. And John, welcome. Nice to have you with us.
It's great to be on your show, Cliff. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you're the publisher of Wooden Books, and you guys put out some very unusual books. What was the idea behind this unique book of different authors from the UK area?
Yeah. Well, I've been very interested in megaliths personally for a very long time. In the UK, we've got some really big megalithic sites. We've got Stonehenge, Avebury is the biggest stone circle in the world. Mm-hmm. And just over the water in France, there's Karnak. And the extraordinary thing about these sites is that although we all look at them and we think we know them, in fact, that we don't really understand why they were built or why they were built the way they were built. And I've been following this subject really closely for years and years. In fact, I co-founded a conference called Megalithomania.
I wanted to bring that up. I completely forgot to mention that you and Hugh Newman started Megalithomania many years ago, right?
We did with Gareth Mills and John Michel when he was still alive, who coined the term Megalithomania. Okay. And over the years, over 10, 11 years now, we've had a lot of different speakers at the conference. We've begun to build up a really interesting picture of these sites and some of the ways in which we think we're getting close to understanding some of the ways in which the megalithic people were thinking or the builders were thinking. Stonehenge is a really good example. If you go to Stonehenge today, you wander around the visitor center, but it doesn't explain to you why there are 56 stones in the Aubrey Circle, or why there are 29 and a half in the Sarsen Circle, or why there are 19 in bluestones in the Horseshoe. And in fact, all these numbers are now well understood. We understand the 56 as an eclipse prediction device. We understand the 29 and a half as the number of days between full moons. And we understand 19 as the number of days in the metonic cycle, number of years in the metonic cycle, which is to say that if you have a full moon on your birthday 1 year, you'll have a full moon on your birthday 19 years later. So we're really beginning to understand that what they were trying to do, the builders of Stonehenge and Avebury and Karnak, was to express in stone a sort of marriage of the sun and the moon and the earth, in particular, the cycles of the sun and the moon.
Okay.
And I just wanted to bring all this new material. Some of it's not that new, but some of it really is very new, and bring it all together and make it really accessible and really, really easy on the eye, mm-hmm. for modern readership.
What was your criteria for choosing each of these people? Were they each of them experts in a certain area? I mean, obviously, Robin is very much involved with Stonehenge.
Yes.
But Hugh is all over the place. I mean, he travels around the world and does visits and records his megalithic ventures for all to see. But, I mean, was there a criteria you used?
Yeah, I really went for people who are very keen, very expert in their field. Like Robin's take on Stonehenge is so great, so eye-opening, but he's also very good on all aspects of stone circles, really. Mm-hmm. Hugh has become, you know, the ultimate megalithomaniac over the past few years, and he, like you said, he just goes everywhere, and so his understanding of the megalithic phenomenon as a global phenomenon is really, really unparalleled, I suppose, other than David Hatcher Childress. You know, he's really got in there. So I chose him to really open the book and frame the subject, because it's so much deeper than people realize. A lot of the circles aren't even circles. They're very carefully designed ellipses or flattened stone circles, and the flattening is always the same. It's just two different kinds of flattened stone circles. They look like sort of eyeballs, these things, and they point to one another in the landscape. I mean, it's really what they were doing is really extraordinary, that megalithic builders. It seems far more complicated than you might think. And mm-hmm. then the second book is Karnak, Howard Crowhurst. He lives at Karnak. Karnak's huge. There are 5,000 stones still standing out of an estimated 20,000 originally. It's massive. And you think of Obelix, Asterix and Obelix. And Obelix, you know, they were putting up a lot of stones in Brittany back then. And that is a site that has defeated everybody. And Howard has actually really made some huge inroads into understanding it, understanding some of the alignments. And he has... He's got a vision that's very similar to what Robin's been doing at Stonehenge, a vision of very early, what you might think of as proto-Pythagorean geometry at Karnak, where you have a 3-4 rectangle, and the diagonals, obviously measuring 5, that's your first Pythagorean rectangle there, give you the solstices. So they found a latitude at which the diagonals of a 3-4 rectangle give you the solstices, and at the same latitude, if you draw a square on the land, that gives you the lunar extremes as well. Hmm. And so you've got these very I'd call it proto-Pythagorean geometry being hooked up to early astronomy. So the Karnak book's great, and then we've got a good book on Avebury and a great one on Stanton Drew, which is up the road.
So it sounds like you're capturing all the megaliths in a series of different books. I know Stone Circles by Hugh was out last year, I think, but and that was a fun book too. Let me ask you this. I mean, for the most part, when I look at the megaliths that we're talking about in the UK, they're raw and dragged, and except for Stonehenge, they're pretty, you know, they're unrefined. Do you consider large buildings that are around that same time period to be megaliths, or is it always going to be stones that are the megaliths?
Yeah, I mean, megalith means large stone, so... And we there are other buildings left, and there are remains of huts and settlements, and extraordinary new dig going on the Orkney Islands at the Ness of Broga, where they're uncovering what looks like a kind of a village or a megalithic university of some sort right beside these huge stone circles up there, and these chamber tombs. But yeah, essentially, what's left after 4,000, 5,000 years, what's left are the big stones. That's all we have to work with to understand this culture.
Gotcha. Hey, I checked on Amazon, and the book sold out of its first run. Are you going to be able to reprint that? I mean,
That's all happening pretty quickly. I don't think it's sold out. I think it's just taken the distributors by surprise. I think the warehouse have been a little bit taken by surprise, and Amazon have been taken by surprise, and their suppliers. I think we're sorting out the supply chain. This should be sorted out by next week, I think.
Oh, excellent.
Don't worry. It says kind of available in 1 to 2 months, but don't worry. It should be a lot quicker than that.
Okay, excellent. So there's another run involved, or some more supplies coming, so people can order it. Okay. Hey, yep. John, it's been really nice to have you speak for a little bit with us. Tell us a little bit about the background of the book, and I'm looking forward to getting my copy. You sent me a copy.
Believe it didn't arrive in time. We tried really hard to get a copy to you, but I don't know where it is. It's probably stuck in an airplane over the Atlantic.
It's
or something.
Okay. Yeah, no. I did the digital version was just fine. So
great.
Hey, well, much success again. The book Megaliths: A Study in Stone, published by Wooden Books, and I checked on Amazon, and it is available. John, much success, continued success, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Cliff.
This week on our review of ancient history, we are taking a look at India and the reference material that we have from Adam Young is some wonderful videos that I had a chance to look at. Hey, Adam, these are pretty cool. Where'd you find these?
Hey, Cliff. These are just videos. I've seen the author of this around a little bit on YouTube, mm-hmm. and he just put out two new ones in April and May of this year. So they're like brand new. They're okay. Fresh. I like his background. I think he's a programmer. He's got a technical mindset, but this is more of a hobby for him. And he puts his face on the videos in the lower left-hand corner.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are, you know, loath to do that. So I want to give the guy credit. He's confident and he believes in what he's doing. So
yeah, the production value on these videos is very good too. They're clean. The sound's good. Let's go to the first one.
Yeah.
It's called Decoding Ancient Engineering Technology at Rampa Temple, and it's India, and it was filmed in May of this year. So talk a little bit about this first one.
Right. Both videos do focus to some extent on Ramappa Temple. It's a really finely architecturally designed and created temple in India. It's got very elaborate, ornate carvings in them, mm-hmm. and it was... It does have some defacement that happened at some point, but there's a lot that survived. And so they're really good examples of ancient technology. Now, of course, mainstream says they're 800 years old or something, and it's possible that there was work done to the site 800 years ago. The true age, the original age, is hard to tell. Mm-hmm. You see evidence of megalithic stones on the bases and the foundations. And very intricate and elaborate basalt carvings adorn the buildings. So
yeah,
there seems to be a lot of evidence of machine technology. The statues themselves are molded like almost like wax. So you don't really see tool markings at all. It almost looks like they were poured into a mold mm-hmm. using, you know, high-tech engraving and polishing tools. And at some point, a powerful earthquake hit. So the temple itself is still standing, but you can see evidence of a number of large megalithic blocks that are dislodged. However, the core structure is still standing. Now, one thing that I found very interesting, and you can see this in the first, I think, first third of the video, so maybe like 6 or 7 minutes in, he talks about how one ruler, or at least someone who was in charge of the area at one point, had chiseled off pieces of some of these elaborate, ornate sort of symbols that are in the ceiling and other places around the temple. They probably sold them off or they kept them in their own palaces. But mm-hmm. when these were removed, it appears that these little figurines, I guess you can call them, were basically carved using high relief techniques. And behind them, there was a small space where they attached to the ceiling. Behind them were more carvings. So when they chiseled off the figurines, you can see a pattern behind them. And you would have had to have like literally like dentist tools in order to get behind these figurines and carve into the face of the actual stone. So it's such an unbelievably elaborate level of precision engraving that you don't even see this in Egypt. Egypt has, you know, a totally different style and everything. But in terms of the high relief that's made in India, I almost don't see any modern comparison.
Yeah, I have... are very, I'm very curious about a lot of the temples in India, simply because they're hard to date. They don't know a lot of the early dates, and some of the relief work is outstanding, and it does appear to be machined. Okay, so the second video that you're presenting is called Floating Rocks at Rampapa Temple. And it is ancient technology in India. What's that one about?
Yeah, so for the first one, if you look into the comment section, he's got links to three other videos that he made that he felt were pretty similar. And one of them, he talks about rock cutting or melting technology, and then some what might be an ancient lathe that was found. And then he references the second one, which I have here, called Floating Rocks of Rampapa Temple.
Hey guys.
Yeah.
And he made this in April, about a month before the first one. He discusses what appear to be man-made bricks in the temple. So not the base, not the megalithic base stones, but some of the bricks that make up the temple walls and the supporting structures itself. It looks like pumice or some sort of a volcanic stone in the way it looks, meaning there's like bubbles or air pockets in it, and they float in water. So some geologists have looked at these and deduced, and you can look at Wikipedia, it says the same thing, that they're man-made bricks. They don't know the exact chemical composition, but they do float, and they're very, very hard. The modern equivalent are, it's called, I think, AAC blocks, and they're basically foam injected into concrete. That's what's used in a lot of countries today to make structures that are, you know, both hard and light, but then earthquake-proof. So if you make buildings out of solid stone and you have an earthquake come, especially if they're made by smaller stones like bricks, it's going to shake apart. But when you inject it with foam, it adds flexibility, strength, and lightness. And it provides some level of earthquake protection. Now, this temple was hit by a massive earthquake. And how do we know that? Is because we can see the large, large megalithic stones on the base and the foundation are dislodged. Some of them are kind of popped up. Mm-hmm. And it looks like there was just some tremendous, tremendous force hit it. But these stones themselves, the pumice-like, you know, injected sort of man-made bricks, seem to have kept the building standing, and it's still standing to at least similar proportions that it was originally, even though the foundation is so massively out of place. Mm-hmm. And today, modern archaeologists have covered a lot of the structure with like plaster of Paris, which is just bizarre. Maybe they're trying to protect it from further erosion, but I think there's a number of different forms of high technology that was used to make these buildings, and it's not clear exactly what all that was, but it's certainly possible, and it shows strong evidence, in my opinion, that it was made by different people at different times, or that maybe a facelift or some renovation happened later on. So
yeah,
all these things really, really hide the true date of these sorts of buildings in India and other places. But I think you can, when you see some of the footage here, you'll agree that the precision engineering is really far and above, I think, what someone would be doing with chisels.
Yeah.
Certainly not copper chisels, but, you know, you also do have basalt, which is not quite as hard as granite. So
yeah, you bring up something that I see in a lot of these temples in India, is that there's very advanced technology being used. I don't know if it's machine-powered tools cutting into these stones or what, but there's definitely a science and technology that isn't noted, isn't known. It's probably lost technology in the construction of these places, which makes me think that they're a lot older than what they've been dated. So fantastic. Good stuff. Okay. Hey, as always, this is great. I'm going to post this information on the Facebook page, which will automatically populate onto the website. And you can look at these videos at your leisure. And Adam, good work, and we will catch you again next week.
Okay, have a great 4th of July.
Hey, you too. Forgot about that. Have a great 4th.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some,
one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Each week, we present three top news items from around the world and present it to you on our Facebook and earthancients.com page. Constantly on the lookout for material. Sometimes it comes from you, the listener. A lot of times it comes from our own research team here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Our first story comes from the Marquesas Islands in the French Polynesian portion of the Pacific Ocean, and the discovery of these new figurines, megalithic figurines, with very large eyes and strange helmets. Many people consider these aliens from the ancient past, but the carving is intricate, large, and in some cases, megalithic in its bulk and size. Each figure has a special helmet, large goggles, and ear coverings that look like some form of machinery. No one's been able to explain the details of these figures and why they built in such megalithic proportions. It's just fantastic. The article features a gallery of photographs taken over the last many decades and asks the reader the question, who are these people? Where do they come from? And why do they build on such large scale? Mesoamerican author Richard Thornton has submitted an article on Totonac concrete. This is a new study of the cement that's been discovered that's many thousands of years old. And he describes the technology behind this very strong concrete that was used to build walls and foundations thousands of years before technology advanced concrete for us. Many of these foundations are still standing today. It's conservatively estimated that the oldest is around 1,200 years old, but it's looking like it could be significantly older. The article features the components of this concrete, the various limestone that was crushed, and the volcanic clay and sand that went into make this very strong and very resilient concrete. Archaeologists have recently discovered the ruins of an ancient Aztec city called Templo Mayor, which is in central Mexico City. And what they discovered was horrifying. They found walls of human skulls stacked 10 feet high and creating a gigantic monument to thousands of people that were sacrificed in their ceremonies. Apparently, so horrified were the Spanish that they covered up these monuments to the sacrifice of these people, and it's only been in recent months that the scientists have been able to dig down and discover these monuments that were left. They're called racks and towers of skulls. One chronicle from that from the 1500s estimates that one rack alone contained over 130,000 skulls. Just a massive display of human sacrifice. You can see this and a number of galleries and articles and weekly posts on the Facebook page. Go to Earth Ancients, go to Facebook, go to the group page, or just go to earthancients.com and you can see all this wonderful content. Today's interview is brought to you by Journey to the Land of the Maya in Mexico. This is our once-a-year trip to Yucatan, Mexico, to visit with some of the best-known and least-known Mayan ruins in northern Yucatan. The tour starts November 17th through the 24th. We meet at Mérida, Mexico, which is the capital of Yucatan. It's a colonial city. It is beautiful. And each day we visit up to two different sites. We have a guide, a personal guide, take us into these locations, Tell us about the background and where available we climb, we commune with these different energetic centers, these Mayan pyramids. And this is a great way to connect with the past. This is a very reasonable tour. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours, and you can see the entire itinerary. I hope you'll join me again November 17th through the 24th, 2018. Journey to the Land of the Maya. I got wind of a new book a couple of weeks ago that was being published, and the title was so intriguing, I had to track down the authors, or as many of the authors as I could. The book's called Megaliths, A Study in Stone, and it was just published. In fact, I read an article in the London-based paper, The Telegraph, that it was published right on the summer solstice, which is quite unique, simply because a lot of these megaliths are attuned to the solstices and the various seasonal changes. And as I was reading this article that came out, and the article is written by Sarah Napton, she basically gives the reader an overview of the contents in this book. And what she had to say, I want to read a little bit about what she had to say. It's a new book, she says. It's called Megaliths, has re-examined the ancient geometry of Neolithic monuments and concluded that they were constructed by sophisticated astronomers who understood lengthy lunar, solar, and eclipse cycles and built huge stone calendars using complex geometry. She goes on, she talks a lot more about it, but that is the meat of the article, which happens to be quite a bit of the book itself. It's quite unique. The book's written by a number of what I will call experts and research investigators who are in the UK region. And today we have two of them. We have Robin Heath and Hugh Newman. And I want to welcome you both to the program today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Great.
I want to read your bio again, Hugh. Hugh's been with us many times. Hugh's written a number of books. In fact, we had him on recently for his books on stone circles, which was quite interesting. But my first guest is Robin Heath. Robin is a graduate of UCNW Bangor and started his career as a research and development engineer in semiconductor technology prior to becoming a senior lecturer in mathematics and engineering. Since 1990, which is a long time, Robin has been seeking out evidence for the prehistoric science embedded within the surviving megalithic monuments in Britain, Ireland, and France. In 1993, Robin founded Megalithic Tours and has written 11 books revealing evidence of high culture to be found in astronomy, geometry, and ancient monuments. We all know Hugh, but I'm going to read a little bit about Hugh. Hugh is the co-founder of Megalithomania Conferences. He organizes a number of tours every year. He's all over the world. I mean, every time I look at Facebook, Hugh's in some distant remote area digging up stuff or flying around. He has spoken at events in the UK, Malta, France, Peru, Egypt, Bosnia, and in America, North America. The thing about Hugh, though, Hugh's becoming quite an author. His latest book, he wrote a book called Search for the Lost Giants. He has just finished a book, which I talked about. We had him on the show, Stone Circles. And he co-authored Giants on Record with Jim Vieira. We had both Jim and Hugh on the program. This is a fun book, you guys. I really got quite an interesting look at what you had been studying. Robin, I want to start with you, and Hugh, I'm going to ask you the same question. And this is fun to talk to you guys about because you're over there. And, of course, you and I, Hugh, have talked about Stonehenge, Hugh, and I've been wanting to get over there, and I have not gotten over there. You live very close to Stonehenge, don't you?
Yes, I live the closest to Stonehenge.
I mean, you could fly your kite out there, and you'd be right over the main stones, wouldn't you?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's like a 10 minute brisk walk or 15 minute, 20 minute leisurely walk.
Oh my God. That's amazing. And Robin, how close are you to Stonehenge?
Well, it depends whether you talk about the one in Salisbury or you're talking about the one in the Welsh Hills, the original one that everyone's trying to find.
The one that Hugh's closest to is the one I'm referring to.
Well, that's the one that Hugh's close to is the Stonehenge that everyone goes to see. But here in West Wales is where the bluestones that built much of the early stages of Stonehenge came from. Mm. And that's where I live. So okay. We both live very near a version of Stonehenge, I guess you could say.
Very good. Okay, Robin, here's what I want to ask you. And this is going to go to you too, but I want to start you too, Hugh, but I'm going to start with Robin. When you use the term megalith, what are you referring to? And what is the... What is the definition in your mind of a megalith?
Well, I mean, the word means a large stone in Greek. But, I mean, when you say megalith to me, it means it has come to mean, after, you know, a long period of time studying the phenomenon of the megalithic culture, it's come to mean to me that I believe that the evidence supports the fact that there was a culture that probably was global, almost certainly was global, that was building these things with unbelievably heavy stones, often moving them considerable distance. And it got me started, this whole word, because something pretty enormous, is similar to the megaliths, is missing from the history books. And it was certainly missing when I first started. And it's missing now in the sense that it's not been taken up by mainstream, that this culture was doing very intelligent things that you can't find anything about in the orthodox publications.
Hmm. Hugh, would you say that the loss of critical analysis by mainstream science to megaliths is because they think they're just dragged and placed there without any kind of thought?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think that's the general academic consensus. It's only in recent years, and thank God for people like Alexander, Tom, and others who are kind of out there in the field, you know, examining, measuring, taking astronomical readings and so forth, and to actually document in an academic way, which is now... It's in print. It's all everyone knows it's there. But even people like Tom, as you know, Robin's written a book about Alexander Tom, who was an engineer at Oxford University and so forth. He got ridiculed and he got kind of ruined because of his ideas that he was discovering directly using scientific methods. And so, you know, there's lots and lots of ways, I believe, to look at megalithic sites, not just, you know, archaeology, where you just dig things up and record what's there, which is pretty basic stuff, really. But, you know, as Robin and I have talked about and written in our books, there's astronomy, there's geomancy, there's hidden energies, there's alignments between other sites, there's, the types of rock they were using have, you know, energetic properties, and the metrology, the measurement systems hidden within them. And none of these things are looked at, you know, by the mainstream, by the academic world. So they're missing out on the good stuff when it comes to actually getting into the mindset of why actually people built these ancient sites.
Mm-hmm. You know, Hugh, it appears that these megaliths, their main one of their main functions is alignment with astronomical features in the sky, be it the sun, moon, and other heavenly bodies. How and where did these people come up with this knowledge? I mean, this is supposed to be the Neolithic period. I think I read that Stonehenge goes back 2,700 plus BC. Where did this knowledge come from? I mean, that's very sophisticated to align megaton stones with the sun, with the moon, with other heavenly bodies to determine time and seasons and things like that.
Well, I'll answer this question briefly, but Robin is kind of the expert on the astronomy when it comes to Stonehenge and other sites. But I just want to briefly mention that, you know, if we go back, as you mentioned, to these wooden post holes, which are 8,000 years old at least, or 8,000 BC. I mean, they go back to the era where Göbekli Tepe in southeast Turkey, another stone circle complex, was just being closed down. And we know there were astronomical alignments. There's astrological, astronomical symbolism on some of the stones at Göbekli Tepe. And they were the first, you know, really, they were the first stone circles, if you can call them that. I mean, they're slightly different to the ones in Britain and other places. But the fact you've got that there, and then we find, and then as the sort of Neolithic explosion happened and the megalithic structures in Britain and other areas were being built, it seems like many of them were being aligned. And, Stonehenge is obviously the prime example, but Robin could probably talk more in detail.
Yeah, Robin, go ahead on that one.
I think if we look at those 10,000-year-old posts, the three of them, that people found at Stonehenge in the early 60s, that were in the old car park, these are huge post holes. I mean, they were tree trunks, massive. But the point is that they, from the centre of the present Stonehenge, they did monitor in 3000 BC the extreme moonset every 18.6 years, which is a latitude dependent direction to look at Stonehenge. It's every latitude in the world has its own solar and lunar specific angles, because the angle of sunrise and sunset on a given day is dependent on the latitude. You understand that, you know, if you go down to the equator, the sun rises vertically, mm-hmm. and more or less has a very little span over the year. But if you live up in the north, you get a huge range between summer and winter sunrises. And people who live in a place know what those horizon angles are of the solstice sunrise. So at Stonehenge, we've got an example of something 10,000 years old. Stonehenge is built right at the very place where the moon set at extreme set when Stonehenge was built 7,000 years later, which I can't help feeling suggests some level of continuity. Mm-hmm. And the reason why Stonehenge is placed where it is might have something to do with those post holes.
That's fascinating.
Well, there's another thing that we could look at here, which is that this particular signature works very well. So the sun and the moon at the latitude of Stonehenge, their extreme rising positions are a right angle. And if you get the horizon level correct and you pick a site with the horizon just a little bit elevated on one side, it is a true right angle. And therefore, this only occurs at the latitude of Stonehenge in the northern hemisphere. It doesn't mean just at Stonehenge, but anywhere on the latitude of Stonehenge, this is true, that this right angle, it becomes a true a relationship between the sun and the moon. And they were using these right angle triangles at many of the sites in order to configure complex shapes for various reasons. Hmm. So to answer, I mean, this is the answer to your question. This appears to be a global thing. And at in Brittany, in Carnac, they were using the 3-4-5 triangle because at that particular spot in Brittany, the extreme sunrises form a rectangle, which is 4 by 3, and the 5 is the hypotenuse. So a Pythagorean triangle emerges from the basic astronomy of the site. Unless you know this, it remains a mystery. And if it's a mystery, it means that you can ignore it in text and you don't write about it in scientific documents when you do your site analysis. This has been part of the...
Yeah, you just mentioned something that I wanted to talk to you about. Robin, you discovered that the builders were using the Pythagoras theorem to build. How is this possible? I mean, Pythagoras wasn't around for 2,000 years after. It's like, how could they come up with such sophisticated mathematics?
The problem there is we've got a bit of mission creep from the media. Because they've only ever heard of Pythagoras in connection with the theorem, they've assumed that I've ever actually connected the two. It's not necessary to understand the importance of Pythagorean triangles in megalithic studies, assuming that they knew Pythagoras' theorem. What is completely important and what nobody seems to have grasped is that once you've got a Pythagoras triangle, there are always whole numbers that make the sides of the triangle in a ratio, 3-4-5, 5-12-13. And the point is, once you've got a Pythagorean triangle, you've got a number system because you can only make one of 5, 12, and 13 units. And the issue now is, if you measure these triangles and you find that each one of those units is in the units of length that we perhaps know, like the megalithic yard or some other unit of the metrological system, mm-hmm. royal cubit or whatever it happens to be, then the fact that you've got another unit system running parallel with the metrology confirms both. It confirms the Pythagorean intention, and the Pythagorean triangle confirms, especially on large triangles, that they were using that unit of length. And that's like gold for a megalithic scientist.
That's amazing.
It's like it's like wonderful things in Tutankhamun. It's just not material. It's not a treasure in the sense of real gold, but it's gold in the sense that it gives you an access into the mindset of somebody from 4,000 years BC mm-hmm. who was thinking and understood how to use Pythagorean triangles to memorialize the relationship between number and ratio.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible in your mind that, and we talk a lot about this on the show, Earth Ancients, that a advanced civilization handed down this information to these Neolithic people to be able to build megalithic sites in such a way that they did align to key astronomical points?
Well, that's a very, very loaded question in many ways, but I think you could find out that it could be possible that the megalithic people themselves were the advanced civilization. It's just that they've been downplayed by various factors throughout history, like the church and the later aspects of Hobbes' thing that people led nasty, short and brutish lives in ancient times. And the idea that primitivism was the only possible way people could live in Neolithic times. Some people were obviously clearly involved in astronomy, metrology and geometry, and they were pretty good at it and pretty accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. Hugh, do you feel that the ancients, the advanced cultures, if there were any, and I believe you believe that they were advanced cultures as I do, handed this information down to be able to perhaps drag megalithic stones, multi-ton stones, and place them in such a level of precision that they became almost like machines in their accuracy?
I do think that. Yeah, I mean, if you look on a global sense, which is one of the aspects I get into in the book, is there is a kind of timeline, if you just look at stone circles, that go back to Göbekli Tepe, mm-hmm. And possibly even earlier. I mean, we have to realize that, just for example, Göbekli Tepe, before Klaus Schmidt died, who was the main archaeologist there, he quietly, you know, mentioned that he thinks it's possibly 14,000 years old, not 12,000 years old, which would push it back to a time that there's no way anything like that is supposed to exist. And there's very sophisticated stone technology, very sophisticated 3D relief carvings, alignments, there's ratios there. They have a 3-4 ratio there in the general design of most of the sort of, you know, oval type circles there. And they were aligning astronomically. So were they part of this so-called advanced civilization? I think you're kind of angling a bit at the kind of idea of, you know, this Atlantean civilization, because that's the kind of time frame they're in. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, I come back to these 10,000-year-old post holes. I mean, the fact that they're there, that is just incredibly strange, you know, that they exist. You know, there are several of them. In fact, Robin and I had a chance to actually get the exact location of them on our last trip to Stonehenge as part of the Megalithomania conference, or a private tour we did there for our group. And there's more, you know, there's more than three. There could be more, that, you know, there's quite a lot there. Mm-hmm. But why were they marking that site, the almost exact location of where Stonehenge is now? Then we have to remember that the area around Stonehenge, Amesbury and Salisbury Plain, is the oldest continually habited site of England, of Britain, really, from that era, 10,000 years ago, pretty much to the building of Stonehenge and to the present day. And so so there is a continuity there. And I think that, you know, if you're talking about this potentially advanced civilization, the fact that they were doing stuff in England 10,000 years ago suggests they were in on it as well. You know, we have to kind of, you know, put that as a reality. Right. And, you know, it's quite possible they were traveling around Europe and the world. You know, we know they had certain types of boats and things like this. We're finding stone circles in Brittany are much older than people think. They're somewhere like 5,000 BC, 6,000 BC. Mm. There's even reports of these kind of dates that Howard Crowhurst talks about in the Megalith book as well. He's done a whole segment in there about Karnak in Brittany, with some brilliant research, by the way. In Portugal, some of the earliest cromlechs or stone circles there are like 5,000 to 6,000 BC. We have discoveries in Israel off the coast, a submerged semicircle called Atlit Yim, which is around that time as well. So we know there was, you know, potentially, you know, very advanced megalithic construction from a very early age. And I think that knowledge would have been passed down to the builders of people like at Stonehenge.
Robin, would you say that the dates are about the same for the most well-known megaliths that you have studied?
Yeah.
You got Karnak, you got Stonehenge, Avebury, and so on. Are they all about the same time frame?
Well, in the 60s, when radiocarbon dating came in, and I was wearing short trousers, then there was a period where the archaeologists were suddenly completely floundering because the Bronze Age was a thousand years too young, and everything was put back by a thousand years, and then some of the older stuff was put back by 2,000 years. And so consequently, none of the signs changed in Britain. It was amazing how tenuous those signs were. They were up for another 25 years after the radiocarbon had redated all the sites. Mm-hmm. There might be a reason for that, and I'll leave your listeners to think what that might be. But the issue now is that the oldest stone circles in Britain are in the Lake District, the English Lake District. Some Aubrey Burl dates them at over 3,500 in one of his books. And I'm just about to put on my website, which you might give your people the website address sometime, but I'm about to do a premature entry of an article about megalithic surveying going on in the Lake District using those very circles. There are the biggest and largest circles in Britain consistently are in the Lake District, and they're not circles, they're flattened circles and eggs and things. So the answer to your question is that the aging thing is still a wheel in spin. We're not, the game is still on, and okay. I'm amazed how the dating is shifting from one place to another. Kakadu dolmen and stone circle in Karnak was dated at 4,800 BC the last time I was there. I've since seen 5,300.
Seems so like it's getting older and older every time somebody goes out there and does a dig, it sounds like.
More or less true. I think, yes, more or less true. You'd certainly bet on it. So wow. I would, you know, the Lake District is the place for some of the oldest and the most impressive architecture done by this culture.
Hmm. That's very interesting, and so we'll have to check into that. Hey, Hugh, you cover Göbekli Tepe in the book. We've talked a little bit about it. You've been there a number of times. This is a megalithic site in Turkey. What's the latest data on these T-shaped stone towers? Are they actually aligned to key cardinal points, or were they used in a similar manner that you would see megaliths at Karnak and at Stonehenge? What's the latest?
In a sense, yes, it is similar to Stonehenge, the way they seem to align. Basically, you've got two central pillars, and they're kind of facing each other. The flat faces are facing each other, and they're kind of humanoid figures, as though they're looking in a certain direction. Mm-hmm. And then you have a very abstract humanoid figures, by the way, but you can see the carvings of the body, the belts and the arms on them. Then around them, you have this sort of oval-shaped, you know, circle, if you like, you know, megalithic kind of ring. Again, these are T-shaped pillars held together by small dry stone walls, and they're very shallow, just resting on bedrock. They're not buried in the ground like we have with the megalithic circles of Britain. But there are some alignments. Most of them kind of a northwest kind of alignments. There are some other ones. There is one to the northeast, which is almost, you know, kind of summer solstice. But, you know, the best research has really been done by Rodney Hale, who's worked with Andrew Collins on this. Mm-hmm. And he's finding, you know, various alignments, especially because, you know, especially relating to Cygnus and Deneb, you know, right. Which is in Cygnus. And, you know, Graham Hancock put in his book that you can't really do astronomical alignments there. You know, they don't really work to Deneb and so forth because there's a big mound in the way. Well, actually, that mound is artificial and was added later after the main structures were built. And so there's still more work being done on that. But I kind of go along with Andrew's stuff. Not only is he a friend of mine, but he's also, you know, the way Rodney does his research does suggest that they were doing something there, you know, with the alignments. I think more work needs to be done because we have so few circles that have actually been excavated that we're only, you know, getting 5% or 10% maximum of the site and therefore of the data. And so I'm sure more will be discovered, but we do find some, you know, orientations, and often they're through, they got, you kind of have these middle pillars aligning to these certain areas of the sky, but they kind of, and also they tend to, there seems to be a hold stone, like a, you know, like a Seenloch, they're called in like Scandinavian German traditions, of like the soul hole stone, you know. And there, and so the, you know, you could be watching alignments through those, is something that Andrew is very strong on. So yeah, I think you know, we have to kind of take it seriously, and they just need to do more excavation there. They're really limiting how much excavation they're going to do, so little, not too much more information is going to be forthcoming, I don't think.
Yeah, that's a fascinating place. That's on my bucket list. I'm going to ask you both some questions now that relate to energetics. And we're at a place in history where we don't have the technology to pick up on real subtle energy coming from stones and things like that. We have some technology that can pick up wavelengths and things like that. But Robin, when we look at Stonehenge, do you get a sense that there is an energetic vibratory pattern that's created by these stone alignments? Because we do know that a lot of the stones have crystalline compositions in them that could take and move various types of vibration. What do you say about energetics in Stonehenge?
Well, I have a problem answering this. And the problem is not that they whether they have an energy or not. The problem is that if I was to divert from the what many people think is the very boring side of measurement and observation and following in the footsteps of Alexander Thom, a job I never applied for, but unfortunately got, but it's been wonderful. The issue here is that the sites at Stonehenge has a wonderful energy at times, and all megalithic sites benefit from, let's put it this way, they don't benefit, you benefit from being in a temple. Mm-hmm. And it's the condition, the human condition, that a temple straightens people out a bit. So hanging about in megalithic sites is a very good way of connecting with things that are bigger than you are. So I have to play the ticket of being my right brain doesn't exist and my left brain is very active. And in fact, this is not true. You know, I'm a dowser. I was taught dowsing by Hamish Miller, a well-known dowser in Britain. Okay. And I still have a set of his dowsing rods that he made in his forge in Cornwall. My wife is a healer, and I have no problem with his other side. But to do what I have to do, you will understand that it takes a lot of time and a lot of energy, and you've got to carry theodolites, which should be called theodo heavies, and you have to carry them up mountains and along ridges and things. If I was to spread my fire too thinly, I wouldn't succeed at anything. And I think what I have to do is to try and take Tom's work and take it further along the road. But the answer to your question is there are very, very strange things that I have seen at sites. Okay. And I've even got one on my website as a photograph. So, you know, that's. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, sure. Hey, Hugh, it's my understanding that the ley lines, which are global, they connect all over the place, are underneath a lot of these megaliths. And if that's the case, then the builders understood subtle energy, understood perhaps seasonal energetics, and placed these massive structures on top of key ley lines. Isn't that something to consider?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, in my book Earth Grids, I kind of talk about all that kind of stuff. I get well into that. But just jumping back to the energetics, which is related to, you know, the question. There are lots of, you know, it's quite a lot of newish research is being developed from that. There's people like Philip Callahan. There's John Burke, Kaj Helberg, who wrote Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. And there's been more developments with more actual, you know, technology, and people are recording energies at these sites now and getting some interesting results. And one of the things that really captured my attention was when it's being revealed that the natural telluric currents that run through the ground and kind of, you know, have been utilized, it's believed, by the ancients. Dowsers have been saying this for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. But when John Burke did the tests there at Stonehenge, at Avebury and other places, and many other stone circles and different types of sites, pyramids and other things around the world, he found that there's one thing which was interesting, that you often get these henges or these ditches and banks around the stone circles. Mm-hmm. And he found that anything that was dug below 3 feet deep, the telluric energies can't go any deeper than that. They only sit a couple of feet, 3 feet below the surface at the most. And so if they hit a ditch or a bank, they then follow it round the path of least resistance until there's a flat area, and then they enter the site. And so often, like at Stonehenge, you have one main entrance, which is a flat piece of level ground, and there's a ditch around the rest of it. And so all the energies would be almost like directed into the stones, and the energies would come in, they would flourish, or they would hit the back, you know, hit the back of the sort of temple where they found the ditch again, they'd hit the stones, and it would be collected almost like directed by the construction inside, and possibly by the people inside when they were working with this, when they were doing ceremonies, when they were doing different tests, when they were placing their seeds there to get them charged up by this energy, which has now been proven to be a reality, that if you place your seeds in a specific part of an ancient site on a specific time of day, it charges it up. When you go and plant it, you get better yields. This has all been tested scientifically by John Burke and previously by the BLT research team, and they actually discovered all this by researching the crop circles of all things, which have a connection with these stone circles. And then you hear, even have Avebury. I just want to mention this is, again, this is John Burke found this out. He went around every stone in the circle, but potentially 99 stones in the main circle and along the avenues as well, and found that every single stone oriented magnetically to one another. And so, you know, when the earth, you know, the rock forms, it creates a magnetic orientation within the stone. Every single one of these was placed according to the next stone and pointed towards it, going round in a circle. So he believed that that was a deliberate design spec, and they were doing this because it somehow, if you could utilize it in the correct way, you could manipulate it and work with the telluric energies and the other earth energies. And we know that, as Robin knows, Hamish Miller, Paul Broadhurst, the huge Michael and Mary energy lines go through Avebury. And so there's a good understanding now. And again, this isn't going to be talked about by academics. This isn't going to be talked about in the mainstream. You have to kind of, these are all the invisible, hidden sciences at these sites, which is something which, you know,
we don't know. We're too immature as science. Our science is just not developed to understand this. And so it's not going to be understood until some young genius figures out a way to scan and collect the data. So it's all poo-pooed because they can't see it. And anybody who's sensitive like yourself, who can walk through these megaliths and get a sense that there is an energy, then, you know, it's all going to be thought as hooey. But let me ask you another question. What is your sense of Stonehenge and these other megaliths that you've been to? Is there healing properties? Is there a palatable sense of energy when you go in and you sit or you're quiet next to these stones?
Yes. Yes, I think is the answer. Even at Stonehenge, even though it's become like, you know, English heritage's cash cow, actually it's a, you know, still a delightful site to go and visit. Mm-hmm. And you can, you know, you can walk, you know, from here you can walk up just behind the stone circle. You can almost touch the heel stone. So you're only 100 150, 200 feet away from the circle. So you can, and then on the solstices and equinoxes, thousands of people turn up there. But if you get there early and get in the front of the queue and you can run fast, you can actually get into the circle on your own and have it for a while. But we also get private access, something me and Robin did a couple of months ago, just for our small group. We're doing it again in a couple of weeks for another group I'm taking there. And I think there's still something quite magical because you don't have the crowds going in there. You know, when you visit Stonehenge, you're not allowed to go inside the circle anyway. A lot of people are very disappointed when they get there. But I think these are built, sites were built partly, not, you know, there's multiple reasons we've been discussing and more to discuss and we look at in the book. But one of the reasons I think it was chosen because it is a power spot. It is a spot on the landscape which had kind of some kind of meaning and energy to them. Maybe they witnessed strange effects there. Maybe someone had an altered state experience at this particular spot. Maybe it was a line where there was underground water met with different earth energy currents. So they wanted to build something to harness that energy. But also this type of energy, which was researched by John Berg, he also found that it was the exact same type of energy, which has this fertilizing energy that actually has gives people altered states and affects the different glands in the brain. And so people would have, you know, very strong, you know, almost like, you know, mental and psychological and visionary experiences, you know, so we know that, you know, is the case. There's a mix between the two. They were using it, the energies, for scientific reasons, for enhancing agriculture, but also to have, you know, altered state experiences and visionary experiences. So I think if you spend enough time there, you go to a secluded stone circle in the Lake District or somewhere more remote, you can spend enough time there, you can really get a sense of these sites and the energies there.
Great. Hey, Robin, what happened after this megalithic period, 2700 BC to, I don't know what the ending period is. It all seems to suddenly have stopped. Why do you think that was? And what was kind of the, is there some indication why they would stop suddenly?
Well, maybe it became irrelevant. The world turned. There are many theories about this, and one of the main ones, which is quite believable, is that the big volcano and subsequent tsunami that wiped out Crete in the Santorini period of 1634, I think it is, marked a big deterioration in the climate in the Northern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. Massive volcano, loads of ash. Summers failed, you know, crops failed. I remember Ewan Mackay, who's a quite well-known archaeologist, telling me that the whole population of Scotland more or less had to evacuate Scotland in a generation because there was no way they could sustain themselves any longer that far north with the climate as bad as it was. So there were no real stone circles apparently built after about 1200 BC. So this is a big question. And it calls into question the fact of energies at stone sites. If you go into the detail of this, you can get altered states by taking drugs. People do, I believe. I'm not one myself, but you know that people do that. And you can get altered states by going to watch a movie or a really moving sporting event where you're very much involved. Mm-hmm. But the issue is here, if you want to get into the mind of the people that built Stonehenge and you want to understand what they were thinking, you're not going to get it by just you don't know what altered states they were getting into. But what you're left with is the tangible material that they seemed, and it's very, very clear to me, that they knew quite a lot about the size of the Earth. That they were using a metrological system that was global. We find the same units of length used throughout the world in monuments. And they were in some way fascinated with the idea of understanding the planet they were on. And what, if we talk about telluric currents, that's one thing. But in fact, all the buildings built by the megalithic culture respond to some sort of work to do with energy. But then so do the Gothic cathedrals that are often built on the sites of ancient monuments. Mm-hmm. If you go to Chartres, you'll get the biggest electric shock you ever got from that place, because it's built on one of the most sacred Celtic dolmens, which is still there in the basement of the, or underneath the foundations of that cathedral. And that brings me to another important point, which I think may answer your question, which is this is to do, may have something to do and with power and how people use power to control other people. For example, if you look at the Michael and Mary energy lines that go through Avebury and work from Cornwall up to East Anglia in this lovely island of ours, sceptred Isle of Britain, there are a large number, a disproportionate number, of military and other sites that are to do with the expression of power. And the Rose Line that runs up from Spain and France right through to northern Scotland and through the Lake District, that goes through the Rosslyn Research Institute as well as Rosslyn Chapel, and it contains sites that are profoundly important for military and other power structures in Britain. And the question that needs to be answered is that the only way we can find out whether that's the case is by actually recovering the metrological system and the surveying system that was being used by people who built the megaliths. And I believe that's the next stage we have to follow. I think that's my job anyway.
So you're basically on a quest to find the megalithic science at play. That's
exactly right. Exactly right. And it's a mixed. It's a mixture of astronomy, geometry, and metrology. And in some way, it's all integrated together. It's very beautiful. Mm. It's as beautiful as a fine painting or a nice, magnificent display of flowers. It's a very, very elegant system. And I've met it at many sites now.
Mm. Hugh, would you say when you travel to other parts of the world and you see megaliths that there is evidence of perhaps a blueprint that was either passed along or the information was conveyed in some way and it's embedded in, say, a site in South America or in Australia?
Yes, certainly. I mean, if you look around the world, I mean, one of the there's quite a few examples, but one of the examples is, you know, obviously stone circles. We're finding them not in, just in Britain. We've got Göbekli Tepe, we've got ones in the Middle East like Karahunj, which is potentially, you know, 6,000 BC. We have even stone circles at Silistani in Peru, which is a megalithic polygonal Chilpa tower site. We have even have a stone circle next to the near the Amazon on the Atlantic side in Brazil. We have potentially double stone circle with an avenue near Mullumbimby in Australia. There's some in India that's been recording records of them in Japan, and the list goes on, even in North America up in New England, so and Africa and Malta as well. So we know that just stone circles are a global phenomenon which may have a common influence or certainly diffusionism. But we look at other types of megalithic structure. We have one of the classic ones is the polygonal walls, which we find most importantly in Peru and Bolivia, but also identical ones appear in Giza and Giza Plateau in Egypt and other parts of Egypt, in Greece, in the west coast of Italy, in Japan, and other places. Again, so big question marks, you know, but why would you choose such a complicated design spec to build megalithic walls the most difficult way? And then you also look around the world and you realize that there are little keys, little kind of signatures of these ancient builders, like the keystone cuts. We have the kind of protrusions or the bosses or the, you know, which we find in different parts, were often linked with these polygonal walls. And the fact that they were carving and cutting rock like granite and diorite looked so effortlessly like they were doing it and creating these puffy polygonal styles. It's just remarkable. And then you actually look at Stonehenge, and every stone there pretty much has been cut quite carefully on most of the faces. They've got mortise and tenon joints. Some of them have got carvings on which may have been done later. There's actually like a protrusion on one of the stones there, and some kind of axe heads carved in them, which were probably done later. But that's one of the only stone circles in Britain. There are a few others, like Newgrange and places like that, where the stones have actually been cut and dressed really carefully, really accurately. Whereas most stone circles tend to be more rough-hewn stones, quite fast-spaced apart, without any lintels, and so on and so forth. And so the fact that we're finding, you know, similarities, we also have Stonehenge, we also find these scoop marks. Looks like they've kind of turned the stone soft, scooped it with like an ice cream scoop. Mm. Sort of as a mostly recumbent stone. I was talking to Robin about this when we were there last time. And then I've noticed that Ollanta Tambo in Peru and Aswan Quarry in Egypt and some other places, we have exactly the same, almost like softened stone with scoop marks,
right?
You know, yeah. So the fact you're getting it at Stonehenge as well is really quite interesting and really needs more research about, you know, how yeah, this could be the case.
If I could cut in there, issue at Stonehenge is it's the only site we have where there's a perfectly level circle of lintels 14 feet off the ground. And therefore, Stonehenge is not typical of the genre. It's as though Stonehenge is a unique monument to the megalithic culture.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, it's completely out there. It's completely different to, you know, everything you find here. I mean, the only similarities you could find are maybe in Ireland with some of the chambers there, where you have lintels and uprights, but they're not the same. You know, it's not the same. And so Stonehenge is utterly unique and quite remarkable.
It is remarkable.
I have scientists on my on this program all the time, and the biggest question, and you hinted on it, Hugh, is the question of diffusionism, the exchange of technology, the exchange of culture, of information over thousands of miles, different people around the world. They the archaeologists and anthropologists just have a real problem considering this because it would change history. Here in the Americas, I travel to Mexico quite often. You look at the culture of the Olmec, and the Chinese scientists believe that they are a version of the Xin dynasty that was around thousands of years ago. They admit it. They see the similarities. They see the symbology. Western scientists just have a problem with this. What do you say to that, Robin?
It's a big deal. I mean, the Chinese dynasty, the very earliest, the Yellow River dynasty in China, there was a very famous gentleman called Needham who went out there and found that they divided the equator into 365 and a quarter divisions. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, to me, that's obviously something to do with the year. And furthermore, the divisions, each division around the equator, they're made to be 360,000 feet. Now, if you multiply 365 and a quarter by 360,000, you discover the present day figure for the equatorial radius. Ipso facto. And as it's almost a scientific suggestion that the foot was determined by this particular set of measurements of deciding to make the solar year, which this fitted astronomy because there are 365 days in the year, and it fitted also a very perfect number for doing sums in a year, in a culture that didn't have electronic calculators, because 360 divides by an awful lot of other numbers, and the factors are very low numbers like 2, 3 and 5, what people call canonical numbers or musical or harmonic numbers. And you know, the fact that that was recorded in China in the Neolithic period is something that you won't read about in an archaeological text. Mm. And there's lots of things that aren't there. And so the answer to some of your question is that the problem is that there's a whole missing bit that should be in our history of science that ain't there. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my bucket list things to do, is to actually complete that list and make sure that people know it exists.
Mm-hmm. What is the resistance, though? Why are these Western scientists resistant to concepts of diffusion when it's so plain in our face?
Okay. This is also a question I've had to address, and it's personally affected my work, because I've been stopped in many areas, blocks, by this problem. The issue was put very plainly by an archaeologist, Ewan Mackay, I mentioned earlier, who said to his students at Glasgow University in 1971, in a sort of video thing that was done in the days of VHF videos, that he said, the problem is that they couldn't, the archaeologists couldn't reckon with the work of Alexander Thom, and they never came to terms with it, I think is the thing he said. And he said, and the reason is that they lack training, that they, there must be something missing. Archaeology pride, this is the quote from him, archaeology prides itself on being a multi-disciplined subject, and yet they never came to terms with Alexander Thom, the work of Alexander Thom. And he said, so something must be missing in the training of archaeologists. Mm-hmm. And of course, he identified that. And the problem, as I see it, is that archaeologists don't do a science degree. They do a BA, a Bachelor of Arts in this country. And they've also had centuries of bias against anybody who talks about megalithic sites in terms of astronomy and dating sites through using astronomy. Our own Astronomer Royal, Sir Norman Lockyer, tried to date Stonehenge, and the only reason he got the date wrong was because the present date of Stonehenge when he did the work in 1902 or something was not accurately known. And Alexander Thom had the same problem. And the reason a lot of his work now looks a bit out of date was the archaeologists were giving him the pre-radiocarbon dating for many of the sun circles, so the position of the sunrises and moonrises would have been slightly different. Mm-hmm. And so it blurred out the accuracy of his work. So we face that problem that training in archaeology is very much a classic subject rather than a scientific subject. Mm-hmm. And the scientists are put off because they think that by phoning the archaeology department and checking something out, that they will get sort of an accurate account of how people dated sites. And also they can ask questions about whether you believe a theory about megalithic sites and stone circles. And the truth of the matter is that the more that this goes on, the scientists are driven because they think the archaeologists have the answers. And what we need is a merging of disciplines beyond the boundaries that are present at the moment.
Yes.
If that happens,
yes.
We could quite quickly.
Interdisciplinary approach is, and when it works, engineering, archaeology, other sciences, it is a beautiful thing to see, but it's rare.
Well, you have to ask why it's rare. Because the common sense thing, the scientific approach says, well, actually, you know, even amongst ourselves in this little group of people that are sold on the idea, there's arguments, there's factions, everyone argues. It's a human condition that is very regrettable, that occurs in religion, it occurs in science and archaeology. But until we get on and stop arguing amongst ourselves and present a united front, which I believe this book does. It's the first compilation album. It's a concept album about everybody writing about the subject. And it's collated well. It's beautifully presented, as you commented on. And that's why I was so enthusiastic to update my bit of that book for John Martineau, who's done a wonderful job of making it work. It's a colossal task to do all those diagrams, and it has in it the history of the subject,
yeah,
which you may have noticed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got all the old engravings. It talks about Stukeley and John Holbury and all the heroes of British stone circles, you know, and mm. even Alexander Thom's in there. And yet, at the same time, it's got all the latest stuff in it. Mm. So, you know, that's going to help, but something needs to knock the heads together between the traditional ways this subject is being approached. And this doesn't mean archaeologists are wrong. They do a wonderful job in what they do. But there's this extra component that's missing from their work, and it's missing from our history books. Mm. It's called How the History of Science Began and How the History of Understanding the World Began. That's more, we don't need to use the word science. It's about the cosmology of a group of people that were going around the world trying to find out answers. And like humans do today, they wanted to know. Like you want to know. You're doing the program and you want to know the answers. I want to know the answers. And we can all get on now, cosily. There's enough information, hard information. And we can get on and start to redefine the model of prehistoric, well, the globe. But I'm particularly interested in Britain because I'm pretty much a home bird, you know.
Well, there is so much we could talk about on this new book and the subject of megaliths. We're down to our final bit of time here. I have just one or two more questions. Hugh, what is the message? What is the decode? What is the what would you like to leave the reader of this of your portion of the book in terms of megaliths? Why are megaliths important? What do you feel?
Well, I think John Michel's 1982 book Megalithomania pretty much sums up. This is why we started the conference with John and with John Michel and John Martineau and Gareth Mills back in 2006. Robin was at the first one, of course, and because it really is. There's a kind of a hunger, a kind of craziness, an obsession you get with these sites. And John Michel summed it up in the book in the, way back in 1982. He's well ahead of his time. And there is a thing about it. Even the antiquarians back in the 16, 1700s were getting like we get now. We don't know what they're – there's a mystery there. We don't really know 100% their real purpose. We're applying everything we can to it, to the subject in many different disciplines to try and work this out. And I think it's compelling for people because these are some of the only things left that you can actually go to, you can actually visit. They're in exactly the same place. They haven't really been moved because they're so big. And it's one of the only ways really to connect with your ancestors or the ancestors or the ancient builders, the kind of, you know, the kind of super smart people. It's almost like, you know, part of the design spec was to, for them to be permanent, to be immortal, like the people who built them couldn't be. And so it was their expression to place them in the landscape for their future generations to witness and experience and to be in, you know, and to like communicate with. So I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm obsessed by it. And I think the book, The Megalith Studies in Stonebrook, is a really good compendium of various authors who have this passion. We're not in it, you know, you don't make money really from megaliths. You don't, you know, it's not like a, you know, millionaire's choice. It's something we all are obsessed by, we all love. And I think we are like antiquarians. We're kind of, you know, going in there with an independent, you know, angle. We're not constricted by, you know, academia. We just do what we want and discuss what we want, and we kind of try and do it the best we can. And that's why we founded the conference. That's why we do the tours. That's why we write these books. It's because we have a passion and a love for it. We're all hardcore megalithomaniacs.
I love it. Robin, over to you. What is your takeaway? What do you want to the reader to get?
My takeaway has just been taken away by you, really. word perfect you there. I mean, you learnt well from the script I gave you earlier. I think that this subject is very much to do with how you see the world and how you live in the world. And the archaeologists dig down and they find bodies. And when they find bodies, they're often diseased and a bit manky and a bit, you know, they've had a nasty end. And this creates the idea of primitivism. But the stone circles have the benefit of being on the surface of the earth. You can see them. And they're huge, massive stones. And you can walk around them and you can sit in them and you can ponder them. And there's a famous writer, I think he was American, Henry James. I think he definitely was American. And he said, if you want to know the meaning of life, you can do far worse than just pondering against the grey stones, against the vast backdrop of time, what life means. And I think Henry James had it very accurately summed up what megalithomania is about. So these things are on the surface. We can go and visit them. Often they're not screened off. I mean, unfortunately, the big monuments in Britain, Avebury and Stonehenge, have got a lot of controlling influences because so many people want to see them. But there are little circles in Scotland, Wales, Ireland, Brittany, even southern England, that you can go and visit and you won't see a soul, and you'll probably learn a great deal from spending time with our ancestors. And it is a way of finding out your lost legacy by going to these places. And we do have a lost legacy in Britain. These are our indigenous folk. I mean, as much as a country like Britain can have indigenous people with all its conquests and troubles, but, you know, these are our ancestors and we must honour them and at the same time learn from them. And I think they were passing a message on, and fortunately the stone circle survived, didn't they? As it says in the film, the dude endures.
Wonderful. Excellent.
Okay.
The book is Megaliths, A Study in Stone. My guests today have been Robin Heath and Hugh Newman. Robin, why don't you give us your email, or excuse me, your web address, so people can check out your latest
posting.
What is it? I'm going to write it down because I want to post it on the Facebook page. What's the?
Okay, it's www.robinheath.info. Simple as that.
Oh wow. Okay. Well, that's pretty quick.
Yeah.
Dot info. Really?
Yeah. Dot info. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'll put that up. And Hugh, what is? Of course, you have Megalithomania, but what don't you have another site we can post? What's your other site?
Yeah, there's megalithomania.co.uk, and also just on the sort of one of the pages on the site, it's just hughnewman.co.uk, and I do encourage people to check out the Megalithomania UK YouTube channel, because we have a bunch of stuff there, stuff that with Robin and and other authors of the book, lectures, explorations of these stone circles. Just to get a sense of it, we made a couple of videos about the book, but, just to give people an idea about what's going on. But, yeah, and, they can just check out hughnewman.co.uk. It's probably the best place.
Excellent. And I just checked before we started the program on Amazon. The book is there. Do you either one of you know if it's available to purchase right now, or do we have to wait?
Well, it ran out during the launch. John Martineau has corrected that, I believe. I think he was overtaken by events. It was a massive response, and its sales were. It was very, very heartening to be part of that machine at the solstice, presenting information, and then hearing that the book was doing with that. The point really is that obviously John has to make a commercial go of this book, but he also runs Wooden Books, which are a successful publishing house. This is just a compilation updated of several of the tomes in there, but I spent most of the autumn updating the Stonehenge book with all the new stuff in it.
Okay.
And I think anyone who's got the old Stonehenge will find that it's been transformed by that, but I'm not really the commercial thing interests me less than does the fact, the information that's contained in the book and the presentation. John does an amazing job of graphics. I mean, that is his main skill. He is a very good man with graphics, and that book is a beautiful book.
Yes, yes, it's unique.
Yeah, Wooden Books UK is the website if you want to find out if it's in stock.
I did not see any not available or not released yet on Amazon. And I was on the American version. Now, there's a UK Amazon that I haven't checked. But here in America, it's really too costly to go to the UK Amazon because it's more money to get it across the boat, I guess, to the States. So.
The pond always costs a lot, doesn't it? Yeah.
So I'm going to assume, and we'll be talking to John shortly to see what I'll ask him that question, but that's a good point. We want to make sure people can get the book, can get it and read all about it. Thank you, Robin, Hugh. Wonderful to have you both on the program. This is a very important book, and you are contributing to our understanding about these ancient sites that are all over the world, and it was fun having you on the program.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Cliff. Appreciate it.
All right. I posted the Telegraph article on the Facebook page, which is also on the earthancients.com page, that describes in detail this book. For those of you that are subscribers to Patreon, I will post a digital copy of Megaliths for you to check out. And if you would like to become a subscriber, just go to Patreon, patreon.com/earthancients, and at the $5 a month rate or subscription, you can download a number of really cool books and galleries and interviews that are not published to the general public. So check that out. That's a fascinating book. Okay, that's it for today. I want to thank John Moreau, Hugh Newman, Robin Heath, and Adam Young, as always, good material. And the crew here, Mark Foster, Curtis Hartog, LeGrand Green, everybody, great job. Good book. Hey, have a great week. Have a great 4th. Enjoy yourself. Get away. Get down. Get relaxed. Enjoy the holiday weekend. And we'll talk to you next week.